really be. That stuff was sending skyward.
And speaking of moving forward, that's going to be the focus of this segment going forward in the show. We're going to be speaking with the author of a book called Powering the Dream, The History and Promise of Green Technology. Alexis Madrigal joins me now to talk about his eye-opening book, that according to the San Francisco Chronicle, on the dream of a more perfect power. Have we seen that dream come true? Is it just a pipe dream? Is it utopia? Are we quickly falling into dystopia before we really embrace the full potential and power of clean technology and more renewable resources? Let's find out. Welcome to the show, Alexis.
Having me.
Yeah, this book is a good one. The last time I had the authors of a book on clean technology was, I don't know, about 5-6 years ago, The Clean Tech Revolution by Ron Pernick and Clint Wilder. Not sure if you're familiar with their work, but I decided it was a good time to revisit the subject, a subject taken on by someone who's, you know, written a whole book about it. So really appreciate your expertise and your authorship and for joining us and telling us really where we are in 2013 as far as green technology
goes.
Yeah,
it's interesting. I think one of the things I tried to do was take a historical view of what's happening with green technology. I think, you know, with any kind of technology that has a lot of media interest and human interest associated with it, you know, it's kind of easy to get caught up in hype cycles that are, you know, last an hour or a minute or a day or a week. And so I think by going back through time, it was helpful in just sort of thinking about where we are now. And I think, you know, things aren't perfect. I think in an ideal world, you'd have consistent government support, you'd have consistent rules and regulations, you'd have a price on carbon dioxide. You have a lot of things that we don't really have in the United States. On the other hand, there's a lot of popular support for supporting renewable energy, and there's been pretty good government support in recent times. I mean, just part of that historical perspective is that basically every single energy technology has received support from the government. I mean, not just nuclear power, which has received and continues to receive all kinds of support, but in their time, I mean, oil and gas and coal have all had support from the government. So, you know, I think when people say things like, well, you know, why do these things need subsidies? They should compete on a level playing field. I mean, well, you know, just historically speaking, that's just not true and has never been true that there's a quote-unquote level playing field in energy.
Exactly. I mean, look at the subsidies that oil companies are still getting.
Yeah, I mean, and there, it's not in any way the sort of thing where you could say, oh, well, the oil companies are a new industry and they need, you know, time to grow and understand how things are going. I mean, you know, the kinds of breaks that they get just are because we think that the country should have energy. And, you know, that might be a social goal that's okay. Like, we might, as a society, be able to say, well, yes, we, in fact, do want more oil and natural gas, and we want those companies to be here in the U.S. and those sorts of things. I mean, you know, you may or may not agree with that, but it's something that, that you can say. But if you're going to say that, it seems really difficult to then not support incentives for renewable energy development.
Just a little bit of the hypocrisy we see and kind of mind-boggling, quote, leadership. As the snow comes down in D.C., as we said, you know, maybe the leaders will get their head out of the snow, if not the sand, soon, as these, you know, increasingly dramatic and destructive storms and weather events continue to pound the East Coast, it seems, lately. But the rest of the country's not been spared either. But let's get back to our neck of the woods. I noticed that you're based in San Francisco. That's where I'm speaking to you from. We have, you know, Clean Tech Alley, Silicon Valley, you know, right down the road. Is this still sort of the center of that movement in this country?
I mean, I think intellectually, perhaps. I think, you know, it's a difficult thing. I mean, the real centers of this are sort of Chinese solar manufacturers and German policymakers. But I think, you know, within the United States, I think Silicon Valley has played Silicon Valley has played a big role. I mean, I think one of the biggest roles that they've actually played was just sort of in supporting some kind of rational policy, particularly at the highest levels of government. I mean, having Google support outright renewable energy, I think, helped counter some of the kind of rhetoric out of the right that you know, all people advocating for action on climate change were somehow like anti-corporate in all ways. And I think that was actually like quite helpful. I mean, you know, I think for activists it's kind of tough because it sort of dilutes the message a little bit. It's not quite as clear that people in corporate land are a little bit more difficult to pin down. But I think that it certainly helped the Obama administration and other policymakers who are trying to promote green energy development, you know, said, hey, look, here are these business leaders who are on board with these activists over here as well.
Mm. And in your book, you give us some historical perspective. You say green technology has been around for about 100 years. I guess you're going back to the steam-powered engine. I guess that would count as cleaner technology, cleaner energy source.
Well, really what I went, you know, I went back to a couple of examples. I mean, water power was very big in the 19th century. But there's also just some great sort of good old American stories about green technology that was developed here in this country. In fact, you know, all those windmills that you see like out, you know, in the country, you know, and they have like these kind of curved metal blades and people think of them as sort of the very symbol of rural life. I mean, one reason is that those things, which are called American windmills, were like basically the most popular personal power technology outside of like the oven. There were maybe up to 6 million of them that were in the world, most of them actually in the United States, during, you know, in periods from the late 19th century into the early 20th. And they really provided a lot of support for other kinds of development. Like it would have been difficult for the railroads to actually span the country if you didn't have a source of water. And what those windmills did was they pumped water out of the ground, because you need, if you have a steam engine, right, you need a source of water, and the windmills actually provided that from underground aquifers. So I think there's a lot to be said and to be included in our history of America that shows that, in fact, you know, this country didn't only develop on the back of the fossil fuel resources that we have. In fact, there were major ways in which renewable energy played a part. And I think, you know, that's part of expanding the coalition for that supports these technologies, is like sort of reminding people this is a native idea to this place, and it's been around really since kind of the dawn of industrialization in the U.S. when you had Lowell, Massachusetts using water power to produce fabric, textiles. Mm. So yeah.
Well, let's talk about some big names. When one thinks of some of the leaders in clean technology, as far as looking towards the future, Amory Lovins always comes to mind.
Mm-hmm.
And as,
mm-hmm.
as far as venture capital and Silicon Valley, you could mention John Doerr. You mm-hmm. say that there's someone we may not have heard of. His name is John Etzler, of today, but yesterday.
Right. Yeah. I mean, Etzler is kind of a fascinating character, right? I mean, I think he was around in kind of like early to mid 19th century, and he was a guy who recognized the power of technology, almost to a fault. And in particular, he supported renewable energy because he felt like it was a more democratic energy source, which is kind of fascinating if you think about it. I mean, it's available everywhere that people are. And, you know, he kind of found some interesting echoes down through time, including, you know, these kind of small government conservatives. Some of them, in fact, one of Ronald Reagan's speechwriters in his 1980 campaign, were actually in support of renewable energy for that very reason. And I think, you know, it just kind of goes to that theme of if people really think about what renewable energy is, there's a really broad base of people who would be interested in it for various reasons. But you don't have to just be interested in small-scale solar or wind or whatever in order, you know, you don't have to just be thinking about that in terms of climate change, that there's a lot of reasons you might want to support that kind of thing.
Were you concerned in writing this book, which I guess came out in 2011, that it might be outdated by the time, you know, it made the rounds and you know, fell into the hands of journalists and talk show hosts like myself? I'm writing a green book myself, and it's not even that specific to technology. It's more about the state of our, you know, politics and cultural mindset on issues like climate change, and I worry about that as I write. Things are changing.
Definitely. I mean, I think every book writer, I think, has to kind of worry about that, just the nature of the game. But I think, you know, I mean, one reason to do a history is that, you know, up until the last, like, 20 pages of the book, you're kind of talking about things that are already in the record, as it were. So I did, but I also felt like there was so much to explore. And there have been people in the past who occasionally have tried to, like, put together some histories of solar energy, some notable ones in the 1970s in particular, when the country was really focused on energy issues. But they're really, it's a really difficult field to get into. I mean, there's so many different technologies, so many different players, and it's kind of unclear what's going to become the most important green technology. I mean, I think right now, wind installations across this country, if you ever fly across the country and look down, you see all kinds of stuff, you know. You know, I think that's just a in the future, we might be looking at solar being a much bigger deal, but right now wind is. And so that makes it really difficult for people to kind of tell the history as a kind of triumphant narrative. Like, in some ways, there's been a lot of failure in green technology. And I think that it makes it a difficult kind of a story to tell.
And there's been a lot of polarization in terms of failure, quote, of Solyndra, which really was not the kind of failure that some conservative Republicans would have us believe. It wasn't so much that solar isn't viable as an industry. It has more to do with pricing and China and other factors, and yet that's been so, pardon the expression, bastardized in terms of, you know, an example of renewable energy, you know, promise and pitfalls.
Oh, yeah. Total one. You know, I think the real deal about this is that anytime you're going to do technology development, you're going to have a lot of failure. I mean, it's just the nature of the beast. I mean, in Silicon Valley, you know, 9 out of 10 companies, right, are supposed to not actually work. And so, you know, you have this whole mantra in the Valley of, like, fail faster and stuff like that. I mean, we need actually that to be part of what's okay in green technology. Not every technology is going to work, and you just can't know until you really start scaling it up and figuring it out. And I think that's one of the things that people just don't understand, that a lot of the way that technology gets better, that they call learning by doing, you know, you don't draw it up, you know, on a piece of paper, and then the technology comes out the other end of a factory fully formed. And this is something that, you know, people have learned time and time again. I mean, there's great examples in semiconductors and just, you know, the chips that Intel makes and other companies. You basically, a lot of the what they do is kind of secret sauce. Like, there's all these little things that impact whether or not you've got a great business or no business. And I think that's something that people haven't really gotten into their heads insofar as we're talking about.
And it's hard to tell if our economy, Alexis, is coming or going. You know, there's signs. I look at the Dow, record high. That looks positive. But unemployment is also still high, and we are in a sequester situation, which is kind of uncharted territory. With that ebb and flow of the economy, what's the current state of investment in green technology? And the other part of that question, because we just have a few more minutes, is it possible to power the American dream, you know, or do we have to change the dream?
Yeah, I mean, I think historically, like over the last 100 years, investment's pretty high. Relative to, say, 2007, investment has fallen. I think that's the kind of easiest way to describe it. Can we power the American dream with clean technology? You know, it's not an easy task. There's so much infrastructure dedicated to not just, you know, fossil fuel extraction and use, but all the things that go along with that. And I think a big part of this discussion has to be what happens with our cities, what happens with where people live and how their buildings work. It's not just going to really be in the actual electrical generation technology. It's going to have to be a much more holistic, all-in solution.
Well, if oil has been the mother's milk of civilization, what do you see as the next critical component to our going forward?
Yeah, I mean, hopefully it's solar energy. I think that that's something that has just an enormous amount of potential from now and until forever. So I think that's a big part of, you know, what I think the future is going to hold.
Thank you so much, Alexis Madrigal. Really enjoyed having you on. We're going to have to perhaps do part two because there's so much more we didn't get into. The book is Powering the Dream, The History and Promise of Green Technology. And Alexis is senior editor at The Atlantic and an award-winning former staff writer for Wired.com and was a visiting scholar at my alma mater, UC Berkeley, just across the bay. That does it for this edition of The Green Front. If you joined us in progress, please check out the archives at prn.fm and also my website, which is thegreenfront.com. In the meantime, have a great green week. See you next time.